Colectivo Raíces presenta su programa
Espejos de Aztlán.
Información,
arte,
cultura.
Bienvenidos.
Bonsoir, vous posez votre question.
Bonsoir messieurs, je voudrais savoir si à 6h heure française, s'il y a conflit, est-ce que ce serait une guerre mondiale, et si oui, est-ce que ce serait éventuellement la fin du monde,
Bienvenidos a su programación de Espejos de Aztlán. ¿Qué hubo, gente? Yo me llamo George Luna Peña. Soy un miembro de la colectiva Raíces aquí en KUNM, Albuquerque, Nuevo México. Soy su locutor aquí en Espejos de Aztlán esta noche y espero que se estén pasando este día conmemorativo muy bien con su familia. Y gracias por compartir un poco de su tiempo con nosotros esta noche. Les tenemos un gran programa hoy. Aquí en el estudio tenemos al profesor David Correa. El profesor es profesor en el Departamento de Estudios Americanos aquí en la Universidad de Nuevo México. Ha escrito un libro que fue publicado hace unos pocos meses por la empresa de la Universidad de Georgia. El libro se llama Propiedades de la Violencia, la Ley y la Lucha de Concesión de Tierras en el Norte de Nuevo México. Y está aquí para hablar del libro con nosotros. Welcome to Espejos de Aztlán tonight. My name is George Luna Peña. I'll be your host on this holiday Monday night, and I hope everyone's enjoying their time off. Thanks for sharing a little bit of your day with us. I'm excited about tonight's show. We have in studio Professor David Correa. David is an assistant professor of American Studies here at the University of New Mexico. He's recently published a book entitled Properties of Violence, Law and Land Grant Struggle in Northern New Mexico. I've had the pleasure of reading the book over the past week, and it's a really great book. In a lot of ways, it takes us in some really interesting and new directions in terms of studies of land grants in New Mexico, property law, violence. And so I'm excited to have David here live and in the flesh to talk about the book. Welcome to Espejos de Aztlán, David.
Thank you, George. It's great to be here.
And David, I just really briefly want to mention that the song that we started the show off with was called Machine Gun by Mano Negra, and it was off their 1994 record entitled Casa Babilón, and I just thought it was a really appropriate song to start today's show with, because Machine Gun, there's actually a machine gun adorned on the cover of your book.
It's a MAC-10 hanging from a tree.
It's a MAC-10 hanging from a tree. And then the name Mano Negra actually comes up in your book. It's one of the many sort of interesting little twists that you take us in throughout the narrative, so I just thought it was an appropriate song.
It was indeed, yeah. It was great.
So, David, before we get into the specifics of Properties of Violence, can you maybe tell me a bit about how you came to the project? What was it about the topic that interested you? Essentially, what led you to write Properties of Violence?
Yeah, I'm not from New Mexico. So, I came to New Mexico in the late 90s I was getting a master's degree in planning at the University of New Mexico. And I was introduced to people in northern New Mexico and Abiquiu and north. And I was struck by, you know, how much the history of New Mexico's Spanish and Mexican period are alive today, particularly through the way that people still relate to each other in the land. And the history of land loss and the dispossession of Spanish and Mexican land grants was still such, at the time and today, was such a contemporary political debate and an issue that it was not something that I saw where I'm from in the Midwest, you know. And it, to me, was the most fascinating kind of history, right? It was people could draw their own sort of their own lineage back right to these first settlers that were coming up. And it was also this incredibly contested history, right, with these histories of Indian removal, particularly Capote Utes in this part of New Mexico and settlers, Anisero settlers, detribalized Indians in Abiquiu with this opportunity to move into land grants. But the thing that I wanted to write was I wanted to write a different history of New Mexico's Spanish and Mexican land grants, because the thing that always struck me was, quite frankly, how boring these histories always end up being, right? When you talk to someone about land grants in New Mexico, particularly land grant heir, they come alive with these stories that their grandparents told them, right? And they bring you back to this particular place and this time. And the histories of New Mexico land grants, though, give you this entirely different impression, right? It's this idea of dead history, that it's just something in the past. And, you know, if it has any importance at all in the present, it's because there was this sort of like pent up rage that emerges in 1967 with Alianza and Tijerina. And then it just disappears again, right? And I just had this suspicion there had to be a really much more interesting story out there. You know, there had to be – I mean, what was happening between the 1890s when speculators were crawling all over the territory trying to acquire massive land grants? And 1967, when 10,000 dues-paying members of Alianza rise up and demand the return of these land grants. If we read the history, it's as though nothing was happening, right? And so I went into this thinking I wanted to sort of figure that story out. And what I came out with was something I didn't expect, which is, you know, this book is about the Tierra Maria land grant, which is really the land grant at the center of the courthouse raid in 1967 when Tijerina and Alianza members stormed the courthouse, which to a lot of people, I think, maybe outside of statehood is maybe the most important event in modern New Mexican history, right? It's like celebrated. Right. It's like a secular holiday in New Mexico. It'll be in a week and a half, right, and in June 5th. And when people think about the Tierra Maria land grant, they think about that event, this sort of really right. dramatic, transformative event that's, you know, catapults Chicano movement activists in New Mexico into the public consciousness and the national stage. And so I was looking at that land grant, and what I was amazed to find was the courthouse raid, as fascinating as it is actually boring compared to the remarkable people and events that precede it in the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s, and also follow in the 70s and the 80s. I mean, the cover photo you point out of the MAC-10 hanging from a tree in TA was taken in 89 during a 14-month standoff between land-grant activists and state police over this parcel of land that today is commemorated with a big, huge billboard of Emiliano Zapata if you drive through.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, this is a struggle that predates Alianza. It raged on in remarkable ways prior to Tijerina, and it continues after him. And it's in many ways completely independent of the really amazing things Tijerina did. And in fact, I think a lot of his tactics in organizing success is because of the work of land grant heirs and activists in TA on the ground in those years before he even arrives.
Right. And I think maybe later on in the show, folks will get a clear idea of what some of those tactics and strategies were that preceded Tijerina, because I think you did a good job of making that clear. But David, your book is called Properties of Violence. So I want to talk just for a minute about property and the way that you conceptualize it in the book. I think the sort of common conception of property is that it's a thing, and you sort of depart from that idea very dramatically. And that sort of departure leads you into some really interesting discussions. And because property is obviously important to your book, I'm wondering if you could maybe just talk about it a little bit in the way that you conceptualize it.
Yeah, you know, I think that everything that I learned about property in this book comes from the land-grant heirs and activists in like the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s, the way they were writing about property, the way they were arguing in courts in the 30s and the 40s about property and how they defined property and how they tried to explain property relations to judges and lawyers was astounding to me. I mean, it was this really remarkably sophisticated set of – they understood how the law worked and they understood how property worked. More than the judges, right? That's probably part of the problem why they weren't able to reacquire the land grant, because judges were just baffled by it. But it starts really with the way that most historians explain the dispossession of Spanish and Mexican land grants in New Mexico, right? It's a simple story usually. It's like, well, here are all these massive land grants that Spain and Mexico distributed to settlers in the 1700s and the 1800s. And it was organized around common property, right? And today it gets romanticized, right? Like common property. Yeah. And here comes the United States in 1846 and the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848 that with their private property ideas. And these two forms of property collide. And it's in that collision that explains why so many Spanish and Mexican land grants were rejected by courts. That's the explanation.
Right.
And that like cuts off any more consideration, right? If that's actually what happened, then there's nothing to talk about, right? It's just there's two things in collision. Now, part of it is it's really shocking that the historiography of New Mexico's land grants still presents this story, because it like presents the people living in New Mexico before the United States arrived as backwards somehow, not modern, right? Pre-modern. They didn't have this sort of sophisticated handle on what property was. I mean, I suppose that's we're prone, like America, like this sort of like the jingoism of America sometimes is prone to just sort of like primitivize people that we're gonna conquer.
Right.
But what I try to do in the book is suggest that the way that land grant settlers, the people living on land grants in northern New Mexico and in southern Colorado, understood property was much more nuanced than these sort of common versus private property notions, right? In fact, the idea of there being something called private property in opposition to something called private property, common property and private property in opposition made no sense, because as settlers were trying to explain to adjudicators in the 1800s and to courts in the 1900s that there's no such thing as common property without private property, and there can be no private property without common property, right? So in a sense, what they were saying was, we dig these ditches, these acequias, together, right? And that's a collective activity at the village level, but we do it so that we can have access to water for our private property, for the crops on private property. And we share the uplands so that we can graze animals and collect firewood and hunt, so that we can, so that the village actually is sustainable for all these sort of private holdings that everyone has, which are completely, fungible, that people were selling them to other people, right? So that common property really constituted private property and vice versa in New Mexico. And Mexico, in the 1820s and 1830s, understood that, right? They understood that you can't settle in New Mexico unless you're providing common property along with private property. It's too arid a region for huge landholdings. For one family, it's too dangerous, right? It was an Indian borderlands that was not secure, and Indian nations much more powerful than settlers ever were at the time. And yet, it's sort of difficult, but it's difficult to get over the idea of property as something other than private, I think, in the way we think about it in this sort of Anglo notion.
Right.
It's also difficult, and this was sort of the more theoretical argument I'm trying to make in the book, it's difficult to get over the idea of property as anything other than an object, right? I mean, it's sort of like, as I say in the book, it's difficult to think of property as something other than we find on the land, just like the trees that blanket the forests above Tierra Maria. But what I try to say in the book, what I'm arguing here, is that property is really a social relation, not an object. Among the many rights that the state enforces with private property or even common property and land grants was the right to exclude, right? And so that means that some people have access and some don't, and the state enforces that. And that what that does is that puts us in relation to other people. And therefore, our property and our property rights then are we express them through our ability to control who gets to access them.
Right.
And so that implies state enforcement, that implies violence. And so what I'm trying to suggest in the book is that if we think about the way that property gets constructed, and we think about property as a social relation, then a much different history of New Mexico unfolds than the very simplified one of, well, this version of property arrives and everything changes. Because it didn't. It didn't change. People were still using the land grant in TA the same as in 1970 as they were in 1870.
Right.
And so all these sort of legal arguments made no difference because right. it didn't work otherwise.
But the conceptualization of property as a social relation reminds me of the cool quote you had, the Blomley quote, that property is a bundle of sticks that you beat your neighbor with, right?
Well, right. I mean, that's usually, if you're any lawyers that are listening recognize this, the way that property is usually described as a bundle of sticks, right? You have the right to exclude, you have the right to use, hold exclusively, the right to rent or sell. And the way Nick Blomley, who's a geographer at Simon Fraser, who writes a lot about property, who I draw on extensively in this book, puts it, it's a bundle of sticks that you can use to beat one's neighbor, right? And actually what he's doing there is something that I'm trying to do in the book, which is like, it's true that property is sort of an object, right? We make it an object, mm-hmm. but it's a completely different kind of object when we define it by meets and bounds and strict legal boundaries. As land grant heirs in the 1940s were trying to explain to judges, these legal notions of property that the courts valorize, of like so many acres defined by specific legal boundaries, make no sense, right? Sometimes I have more cows than my neighbor. Sometimes it's a wet year than others. Sometimes I have sheep and not cattle. And those years, the land that I need to raise these animals is different than previous years. And judges couldn't make heads or tails out of these arguments, right?
Right.
And so, in a sense, there was this sort of legal collision, but it wasn't the one that happens in the 1870s and 1880s. This is happening in the 20th century. So really, the kind of explosive argument I'm making here is that land grant disposition didn't happen in the territorial period. It happened in the after statehood, and it continues
right.
to happen today because it's this constant struggle over property.
And so, David, you mentioned Indian nations, and so I'm wondering if you could briefly, because one of the things that you add that's been missing from a lot of land grant historiography is that connection between land grants and common property and sort of the history of Indian displacement and removal in New Mexico. So I'm wondering if you could maybe just briefly for a minute mention that and talk about that.
Yeah, this is the third rail of land grant politics, in my opinion, in New Mexico. It's the inability, I think, sometimes to honestly come to terms with the history of Indian removal that served as the very condition for these Mexican claims, right? So this is a Mexican land grant in New Mexico and TA, and it exists today because Capote Utes were driven off, and the settlers who came to claim it were active in that effort. They were active, and they were a part of militias that forcibly moved Capote Utes off the land. And so often, you know, when I talk to people about land grants in New Mexico, if you have as an interest Spanish and Mexican land grants, you'll often get, well, they don't deserve any of our sympathy because they stole the land from the Indians first. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm trying to say is, well, let's honestly look at that history. Let's sort of figure out exactly what happens. Land grant history, for the most part, has ignored that question. It sort of bracketed that out and said that's a different historical set of issues. And it's not. It's central to this issue. And what we find in TA, right, is that most of the people that were moving north into these land grants during the Spanish and Mexican period were landless sheep herders and agriculturalists, desperate for land. They had no other choice. They were pawns in this sort of like violent war between the elites in Spanish society in New Mexico and more powerful Indian nations. They were a buffer, right? And also many of them, particularly those up in TA and Petaca and Vallecitos de Lavato and other land grants, were themselves like the children or grandchildren of detribalized Indians, that function of sort of the slave trade in the borderlands. And New Mexican governors didn't know what to do with these people, right? Mm-hmm. And so they gave them these land grants in northern New Mexico. So to say that we're talking about Indian mm-hmm. removal is a simplified way to say that we're talking about a really complicated and no doubt violent history that it's really hard to unravel. So the first chapter is really, I'm trying to figure that out, really
right.
figure out that history. And it's much more complicated and surprising a history than we're led to believe.
Right. And as you said, it's sort of wrapped up with violence. And so let's talk a little bit more about violence. Your book focuses a great deal on violence, but rather than focus on sort of the violence of of land grant activists, as a lot of land grant historiography has done. You sort of flip the script, I guess, and bring our attention instead to state-sponsored violence, racialized state-sponsored violence. And this goes well, obviously, with your argument that violence is not sort of the opposite of law, but instead they work together in tandem. I guess violence is sort of essential to law's operation. So let's spend a little bit of time talking about state-sponsored violence that you cover in your book.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the things that drew me to this topic. When I was in graduate school doing research on my dissertation, I came into the archives here at UNM, and Reyes Lopez Tijerina's collection is here. And the first six boxes are FBI documents. And I wasn't working on this at the time, but one day I spent a week just looking through them, like, what's this about, right? And what I found blew my mind, and it makes up one of the chapters in this book, which is, you know, in the years before the courthouse raid and in the years after, the land-grant movement, and particularly Tijerina and Alianza, was a target of J. Edgar Hoover and COINTELPRO, and the New Mexico State Police also set up sort of the secret paramilitary squad of agents provocateurs that tried to undermine the land-grant movement. And they in these memos between Hoover and his agents in New Mexico, they were very clear that the land-grant movement represented a threat to national security in their terms, and it was always put in racialized terms, right? And a number of historians have talked about the way in which race for Hoover's FBI was a proxy for subversion, right? So that difference gets described as dangerous. And particularly Spanish-speaking difference, right? It was like they're not American. So there was always this effort to try to prove that land-grant activists were agents of foreign powers. And so there was an enormous amount of physical violence. I'm not just talking about, you know, violence in a sort of a metaphorical term. There was an enormous amount of physical violence directed at Alianza members, Tijerina and his family, both before and after, right? And my argument about property, too, is about property only is elevated legally property when it's enforced by the state. So the years of legal struggles in the 30s, 40s, and 50s culminate with the state enforcing private property, and they do that violently. Mm-hmm. So land grant members and TA and other land grants become targets of state violence. And so I try to tell that story, and it's also a really surprising story because it doesn't end with Tijerina out of the picture, right? It just shifts so that in the 60s, land-grant activists are identified as racialized threats to sovereign authority in the U.S. That's how Hoover defines them. And in the 70s and 80s, it shifts, right, to their domestic terrorists.
Right.
And it's the logic of domestic terrorism, and the investigations of land-grant activists are housed in the domestic terrorism unit of the FBI. And this is after J. Edgar Hoover, right? In fact, I spent a lot of time requesting through Freedom of Information Act requests documents associated with investigations of various activists related to the land grant movement in TA. And time and again, what I would get would be these memos linking land grant activists in New Mexico to domestic terrorists of all kinds, and particularly Puerto Rican nationalists and separatists. And as late as 2005, the FBI was surveilling TA from airplanes, as I point out in one of the footnotes, actually, trying to determine if it still is, as they thought, this hotbed of Chicano militancy in the Southwest.
Right. And so, David, you mentioned briefly in that past answer the legal cases in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And so I'm going to go backwards just for maybe a minute or two, if you wouldn't mind talking about some of those, because I think, like you said earlier, there's sort of theft happened, and then there's this huge gap, and then Alianza happens, and then, you know, the courthouse raid happens in 67, and there's 60 or 70 years there where it's assumed that nothing is happening, or it's written out, right? And so you sort of, I think, very masterfully show us that wasn't the case, and there were some really sophisticated things happening. So could you maybe just talk a little bit about those court cases? And then also, one of the things that struck me was that they weren't just, sort of legal challenges, but they were also performing, as you said, performance of property. They were also doing all sorts of things to try to prove that this was, in fact, their land. Could you talk just for a minute about that?
Sure, yeah. So it really starts in the mid-30s after a period of sort of rural unrest and fence cutting and incendiarism. And then land-grant activists start organizing around this idea of taking these issues to the court. And they recognize that the law has dispossessed them of the property, and so they're going to go to the courts and try to find redress. And they do that in really sophisticated ways. And they recognize first, okay, we have to make our claims legible to the courts. And they realize that people who behave like property owners get recognized as property owners. So they start taking down fences from private ranchers and erecting their own fences and putting up no trespassing signs and mailing eviction notices to private ranchers and mailing rental bills to private ranchers, right? And these are people who, you know, these private ranchers trace their deeds way back to the 1800s when the speculators acquired TA. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to convince the court, okay, Mexico gave this land grant to us and held the commons on behalf of the land grant members. And when the United States arrived, that responsibility to the commons was shifted to the United States. Mm-hmm. And the United States then confirmed the land grant to a single person who then sold it off. And the argument in court was just because the Congress confirmed the land grant to this one person named Francisco Martinez doesn't mean that they erased that obligation to manage the commons for everyone. Right, that responsibility was still in place. And the courts time and again said, no, we can't go behind an act of Congress. They made it a private land grant. And they were trying to say, just like a priest at a church can't alienate the land of the church, neither can this land grant settler alienate the common lands. It's their responsibility to hold it in common for everybody. And so the arguments in the courts really revolved around those questions. And they're sort of really complicated but fascinating arguments. I know we don't have time to go into them today, but they were really smart about the way they're trying to do it. So at the same time they're in court making these arguments, they're outside of the court behaving like property owners, right? And because that's precisely what courts do, right? They're looking for property is a kind of performance, right? You perform your property by possessing it exclusively. You put up signs. You rent it out. You charge somebody for accessing it if you're going to be a renter. So they were doing all those things in ways that – and proving that they had acquired it through adverse possession. And it was sort of the court time and time again going through this remarkable legal acrobatics to fight against them time and time and again. So I'm putting those court cases against one another to show how absurd it was for the courts to fight against them.
And so, David, and again, that's – part of the history that doesn't get written about.
It's never. I mean, in fact, I couldn't even find records of those court cases in the state of New Mexico. I had to go to Colorado to find them. They'd never been accessed by historians before. This is a story that even when I was interviewing people in CIA, they were unfamiliar with. They had forgotten, like, you know, even there was sort of like memory of some sort of organizing going on, but that it went to court was really unknown to people.
Right. And so, David, we are unfortunately running out of time, but what maybe in like 30 seconds, and I know that's sort of impossible, but what's happening in Tierra Maria today?
Well, it's one of the ironies that I talk about in the epilogue. You know, the Jicarí Apaches and the Capote Utes were removed in the 1870s, violently removed, and the Jicarías were moved west and have become fairly wealthier in comparison to land-grant heirs in TA and have started to buy the land-grant back. And so on top of the upscale residential development that's happening in the former commons, the Jicarí Apache Nation has bought about over a quarter of the land grant back. And it's sort of ironic return to Indian ownership in the region.
Wow. And so, David, like I said, we are running out of time. Is there anything you would like to add?
Well, only that I think that this issue of land grants will come up again in a week and a half when Reyes López Tijerina visits New Mexico to celebrate another anniversary.
That's June 5th, right?
June 5th, the anniversary of the courthouse raid in 1967. And I really did write this book to try to tell a story that was more than just a story of one man and one group, but rather a story about this land grant that for generations after generations has been struggling around these issues, completely independent of that history of Alianza and Tijerina.
Great. Well, David, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your thoughts with us. I can, you know, just from reading the book, I can tell that there was a ton of work that went into it. And so appreciate that. And thanks for sharing some time with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me, George.
And also, I want to say thanks to Guille from the Raíces Collective for engineering for us tonight. She hit all the switches and made sure everything ran smoothly. So thank you, Guille. My name is George Luna Peña. This has been Espejos de Aztlán.